Then I bowed low. I sat down and I wept. The tears streamed down my face, for on every side was a waste of water. 14 leagues distant, there appeared a mountain, and there the boat grounded. Berossos again. Then Xisuthros knew that the earth had once again appeared. He disembarked, accompanied by his wife and daughter together with the steersman. He prostrated himself in worship of the earth, and set up an altar and sacrificed to the gods. After this, he disappeared, together with those who had left the ship with him. Those who had remained on the ship and had not gone out with Xisuthros searched for him and called out for him by name all about. But Xisuthros from then on was seen no more, and the sound of a voice that came out of the air gave instruction that it was their duty to honor the gods, and that Xisuthros, because of the great honor he had shown the gods, had gone to the dwelling place of the gods, and that his wife and daughter and the steersman had enjoyed the same honor. The voice then instructed them to return to the city of Sippar, to dig up the tablets that were buried there, and to turn them over to mankind. The place where they had come to rest was in the land of Armenia. So, in summary, both the biblical and Mesopotamian accounts agree that Armenia was the place of refuge for the survivors of the flood. Berossos, however, adds some important details missing from the Old Testament story. These are, first, the reference to Sippar, which, as we've seen, was one of the 5 antediluvian cities remembered in Sumerian traditions. Secondly, the intriguing information that writings or archives from antediluvian times, all the tablets, the first, the middle, and the last, were buried at Sippar before the flood struck. And thirdly, that the survivors were to return to Sippar when the waters had receded in order to dig up the buried tablets and turn them over to mankind. What is envisaged here, therefore, is nothing less than a renewal of civilization after a global cataclysm, a renewal in which antediluvian knowledge was to be recovered and repromulgated. The 7 sages, however, would no longer have any part to play in the spread of that knowledge. The cuneiform texts tell us they had been sent back to the depths of the Abzu at the time of the flood and ordered never to return. Other sages of human descent, though in one case described as being 2/3 Apkalu, would take their place. Some continuity would be maintained and civilization would rise again. In due course, later kings would speak of their link to the antediluvian world. In the late 1st millennium BC, Nebuchadnezzar I of Babylon described himself as a seed preserved from before the flood, while Ashurbanipal, who ruled the central Mesopotamian empire of Assyria in the 7th century BC, boasted, "I learned the craft of Adapa the sage, which is secret knowledge. I am well acquainted with the signs of heaven and earth. I am enjoying the writings on stones from before the flood." It is a curious mystery, as we shall see in the next chapter, that the exact same notions of the 7 sages as the bringers of civilization in the remotest antiquity, and of the preservation and repromulgation of writings on stones from before the flood, turn up in the supposedly completely distinct and unrelated culture of ancient Egypt. Part 4. Resurrection. Chapter 9. Island of the Ka. The banks of the Nile are lush, lined with palms and green fields, but they are narrow, won from the surrounding deserts thanks only to the gift of fertility bestowed upon them by the eternal river. It's the same story all the way from Cairo to Aswan, where the high dam has permanently changed the divine landscape of the pharaohs by creating Lake Nasser, one of the largest man-made bodies of water in the world, which continues south to cross the border with the Sudan. As the level of the lake rose during the 1960s, many ancient Egyptian sites, such as the fortress of Buhen, were submerged. Others, such as the world-famous Abu Simbel, and the stunningly beautiful little temple of Isis at Philae, were rescued by being moved block by block and re-erected on higher ground. Others still were dismantled and shipped overseas. For example, the Temple of Dendur, now in New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Temple of Debod, now in the Parc del Oeste in Madrid, and the Temple of Tafe, now in the Rijksmuseum in Leiden in the Netherlands. By such means, the sacred realm of the gods that continuously remade and remanifested itself in Egypt over untold thousands of years in antiquity can be said still to undergo resurrection and rebirth in far-off lands even today. So it was too, according to its own inscriptions, with the Temple of Horus at Edfu, known as Bidet in ancient times, hence its patron, the falcon god Horus, is often referred to as Horus the Bedetite. Edfu stands on the west bank of the Nile, 110 kilometers, 68 miles, north of Aswan, and was thus spared from flooding by Lake Nasser. The temple as we see it today, its golden sandstone blocks radiant and graceful beneath the fierce sun of Upper Egypt, is relatively young. The whole complex having been completed during the Ptolemaic period in a series of stages between 237 BC and 57 BC. In every meaningful sense, however, what confronts us here is merely the latest incarnation of much older temples that previously occupied this site, dating at least to the Old Kingdom, 2575 to 2134 BC, and perhaps far beyond. Of the greatest interest, at any rate, is the temple's idea of itself, expressed in the acres of enigmatic inscriptions that cover its walls. These inscriptions, the so-called Edfu building texts, take us back to a very remote period called the early primeval age of the gods. And these gods, it transpires, were not originally Egyptian, but lived on a sacred island, the homeland of the primeval ones, in the midst of a great ocean. Then, at some unspecified time in the past, a terrible disaster, a true cataclysm of flood and fire, as we shall see, overtook this island, where the earliest mansions of the gods had been founded, destroying it utterly, inundating all its holy places, and killing most of its divine inhabitants. Some survived, however, and we're told that this remnant set sail in their ships. For the texts leave us in no doubt, these gods of the early primeval age were navigators, to wander the world. Their purpose in doing so was nothing less than to recreate and revivify the essence of their lost homeland, to bring about, in short, the resurrection of the former world of the gods, the recreation of a destroyed world. The general tone, as Egyptologist Eve Ann Elizabeth Raymond confirms in her masterful study of the Edfu building texts, conveys the view that an ancient world, having been constituted, was destroyed, and as a dead world, it came to be the basis of a new period of creation, which at first was the recreation and resurrection of what once had existed in the past. Important in the evaluation of the texts is the realization that they were not composed in the historical temple. On the contrary, as Raymond informs us, the priests and scribes of Edfu merely copied what they regarded as the more important extracts from a vast archive of ancient documents that they had at their disposal. By the 5th century AD, the weight of Roman and Christian fanaticism had brought about the final collapse of ancient Egyptian civilization. Thereafter, with Islamic hatred of the past soon making things even worse, care ceased to be taken of the temples, which were used as storerooms, stables, and homes by local people who no longer venerated the ancient gods. In 1837, the English explorer Howard Vyse visited Edfu and described the mess that he found inside. The temple itself, one of the most imposing in Egypt, affords a striking contrast to the miserable hovels, many of which are built upon it and others on vast mounds of rubbish with which it is surrounded. The interior, covered with painted hieroglyphics, has been divided by earthen walls to form a magazine for corn, and beneath it are enormous substructions which I entered by a hole from an Arab house. They were full of dirt and filth of every description, but had been built in the most solid manner. Fortunate for us, then, when Edfu still thrived, that priests and scribes who could read the mysterious texts in the temple's library committed themselves to the project of selecting extracts and carving them deeply into the solid and imposing walls of the temple itself. In so doing, whether by accident or design, they ensured that at least these fragments have survived to the present day, whereas the original source documents, looted, used as kindling, thrown into the Nile during the centuries of neglect and mistreatment, have long gone. Inevitably, since they lack their original context, the fragments are often confusing and deeply tantalizing. Even so, they give us a glimpse into wonders and secrets of our past that the source documents, if only we had them, might have revealed to us much more completely. Atlantis in Egypt. The famed Greek philosopher Plato, who passed down to us the extraordinary story of Atlantis, destroyed in a terrible cataclysm of flood and fire 9,000 years before the time of Solon, in other words, in 9,600 BC in our calendar, is generally regarded by archaeologists as having made up the whole tale of the lost Ice Age civilization. The fallback position amongst those grudgingly willing to admit some veracity to the information conveyed in the Timaeus and Critias is that Plato had perhaps based his account on a much more recent cataclysm, centered on the Mediterranean. For example, the eruption of Thera, Santorini, in the mid-second millennium BC. The notion of a global disaster more than 11,000 years ago, and particularly the heretical idea that it could have wiped out a high civilization of that epoch, is strenuously resisted and indeed ridiculed by the archaeological establishment because, of course, archaeologists claim to know that there was not, and never under any circumstances could have been, a high civilization at that time. They know this, not because of any hard evidence which absolutely rules out the existence of an Atlantis-type civilization in the Upper Paleolithic, but rather on the general principle that the result of less than 200 years of scientific archaeology is an agreed timeline for civilization that sees our ancestors moving smoothly out of the Upper Paleolithic into the Neolithic, both by definition Stone Age cultures, at around 9,600 BC, and then onwards through the development and perfection of agriculture in the millennia that followed, a process that also witnessed the founding of some very large permanent settlements such as Çatalhöyük in Turkey, around 7,500 BC. By about 4,000 BC, the increasing sophistication of economic and social structures and growing organizational abilities made possible the creation of the earliest megalithic sites, such as Gigantea on the Maltese island of Gozo, for example, while the first city-states emerged around 3,500 BC in Mesopotamia and the Indus Valley, and soon afterwards in Egypt and on the other side of the world in Peru. The pyramids of Giza are megalithic monuments, so too the Great Sphinx. In the British Isles, Callanish in the Outer Hebrides and Avebury in southwest England, both dated to around 3000 BC, are the oldest examples of true megalithic sites. The megalithic phase of Stonehenge is thought to have begun around 2400 BC and have continued to around 1800 BC. Within this well-worked-out and long-established chronology, there is simply no room for any prehistoric civilization such as Atlantis. Hence the wish of the mainstream to dismiss Plato's outlandish story by any and every possible means. These means include ridicule of the supposed Egyptian basis for the tale, specifically of the claim, made in the Timaeus, that priests of Sais in the Delta said Atlantis and its cruel fate were described in sacred records in their temple going back thousands of years before the established beginning of Egyptian civilization in the late 4th millennium BC. To those wedded to the orthodox chronology, the very idea that the priests of Sais might have given Solon a true account of such impossible records, which in due course reached Plato, seems preposterous, an obvious historical oxymoron which deserves only to be ignored. Furthermore, the claim is frequently made that there are no references to Atlantis anywhere in surviving ancient Egyptian papyri and inscriptions. Only one Egyptologist, the late Professor John Gwynne Griffiths of the University of Wales at Swansea, who passed away in 2004, had the courage to challenge the consensus. The challenge he presented, however, had nothing to do with the fundamental point of whether Atlantis existed and was destroyed in the 10th millennium BC, but rather with the lesser point of whether Plato, through his ancestor Solon, could indeed have been influenced by genuine ancient Egyptian traditions. Oddly enough, for so learned a man, Griffith seems to have known nothing of Edfu, with its tempting account of a sacred island inhabited by gods, and destroyed by flood and fire in primeval times, an obvious prototype for Plato's Atlantis, as we shall see. The professor's focus instead was on a papyrus, catalogued as P. Leningrad 1115, and now kept in Moscow, which contains an intriguing prose story known as The Tale of the Shipwrecked Sailor. In this fairy tale, dating to Egypt's Middle Kingdom between 2000 BC and 1700 BC, Griffiths, quite correctly in my view, did find convincing resemblances to Plato's account of Atlantis. The eponymous shipwrecked sailor in the papyrus tells us of a time when he made a voyage in a great ocean-going vessel that was struck by a giant wave. Then the ship died. Of those in it, not one remained. I was cast on an island by the sea. I spent 3 days alone, lying in the shelter of trees. I hugged the shade. Then I stretched my legs to discover what I might put in my mouth. I found figs and grapes there, all sorts of fine vegetables, sycamore figs and cucumbers that were as if tended. Fish there were, and fowl. There is nothing that was not there. I stuffed myself and put some down, because I had too much in my arms. The shipwrecked sailor cuts a fire drill, makes fire, and gives a burnt offering to the gods. Then I heard a thundering noise. Trees splintered, the ground trembled. Uncovering my face, I found it was a snake that was coming. He was of 30 cubits, 15 meters or 50 feet. His body was overlaid with gold. His eyebrows were of real lapis lazuli. Then he took me in his mouth and carried me to the place where he lived and set me down unhurt. The serpent questions the sailor on how he came to be on the island, and on hearing his reply, tells him not to be afraid. It is a god who has let you live and brought you to this island of the Ka. There is nothing that is not upon it. It is full of good things. The name Island of the Ka is curious, notes Miriam Lichtheim, the translator of the tale. She adds that the renowned Egyptologist Sir Alan Gardiner rendered it as Phantom Island. It's beyond the scope of this book to present a detailed treatise on the concept of the Ka, the double, the astral or spiritual essence of a person or thing. It existed with the human being during his or her mortal life, but was the superior power in the realms beyond the grave. Indeed, the term for death in the ancient Egyptian language meant going to one's Ka, or going to one's Ka in the sky. The gods were also believed to have their Kas, and so too were the great monuments of Egypt. Of particular relevance here is that the high god Osiris, lord of the celestial afterlife kingdom known as the Duat, was always referred to as the Ka of the pyramids of Giza. The Ka entered eternity before its human host, having served its function by walking at the human side to urge kindness, quietude, honor, and compassion. Throughout the life of the human, the Ka was the conscience, the guardian, the guide. After death, however, the Ka became supreme. With this in mind, Gardiner's suggestion that a phantom island is implicated in the tale of the shipwrecked sailor makes sense. The sailor has set out in a boat from the physical realm of Middle Kingdom Egypt, but he has been cast ashore on the island of the Ka, a ghost realm, a place that no longer exists in this world, except in the form of its spiritual essence. The same theme continues as the huge snake that rules the island tells the sailor his sad story. I was here with my brothers, and there were children with them. In all, we were 75 serpents, children and brothers, without mentioning a little daughter whom I had obtained through prayer. Then a star fell, and they went up in flames through it. It so happened that I was not with them in the fire. I was not among them. I could have died for their sake when I found them as one heap of corpses. In due course, a ship passes by and the sailor is rescued. The snake king of the island sends him away with rich presents.